This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, Bokeh Tov. Okay, the men of the Great Assembly, Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Imagine that during this week, you probably have heard or will hear from others about the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And I would like to address, I think we don't need a right microphone.
Terrific.
I think we're okay. Okay, I would like to address the issue of who these people were and their significance within the Jewish history, Jewish spiritual history, from a point of view of what I would call spiritual leadership. In other words, besides the fact that we could speak about the Anshei Knesset HaGdola as perhaps a group of people who initiated what became Judaism pretty much until today, what we call Rabbinic Judaism, vis-a-vis the Tanakh, prophetic Judaism. I think I would like to try to address another aspect of their contribution and their importance. And that's something that I call, what we like to call, a very precious commodity within the history of the Jewish people, and that is spiritual leadership. What I mean by spiritual leadership is that in every generation, it's necessary that those who are supposedly the elders of the Jewish people, those who have spent many years of their life concentrating on the Torah, are not only able to teach Torah, not only able to make decisions in terms of the halakha, but are able to perceive perhaps the underlying issues, educational, spiritual issues, that confront the Jewish people in that generation, and were able to create a response, a significant response that successfully dealt with those issues, whether we're talking about within the context of the community, within the context of individual life in terms of questions of faith, etc. Sometimes we speak about Rabbi Soloveitchik as not only a person of intellectual greatness and tremendous knowledge of Torah, but someone who perhaps here and there in created modern orthodoxy, let's say, in the United States. And he did that not only by confronting basically the intellectual and spiritual issues that confronted, Judaism in the new context of modernity, but he also was involved here and there in the creation of Yeshiva University, the creation of certain institutions in religious Zionism. Some would like to think of the Lubavitcher Rebbe as someone who was able to lead and confront issues. And I'd like to speak about the Anshei Knesset HaGdola in that context. I'd like to say right from the beginning that something that we spoke about a little bit last year, those of you who heard last year, there are occasionally periods in Jewish history that are formative periods. Periods in which the Jewish people undergo a significant crisis, a significant, sometimes it has to do with an event that is catastrophic, that is destructive. And it requires, in its wake, there's a very unique period in Jewish history where there was a need, in a sense, to recreate, perhaps, Judaism itself in a certain way. Sometimes I look at the period that we live in today, the generations, the period that we live in today, as a period that is of that kind. The revolutionary events that overtook our people in the 20th century, of course, the Shoah, which was catastrophic, but in a sense, there are a number of very, very significant events demographically, sociologically, culturally, spiritually, educationally, that the Jewish people went through in the 20th century. The confrontation with modernity, with the explosion of technology, the development of the social sciences and humanities, and the way of thinking that that brought into the world, psychology, sociology, anthropology, etc. The question of historical relativism. That's one area. And if that wasn't enough, right, there was this tremendous dislocation of Jewish communities that carries the Jewish people from one place in the, from a number of places in the earth at the beginning of the 20th century and places them somewhere else at the end of the 20th century. Right, at the beginning of the 20th century, most of the Jews in the world lived in Russia. So it became the Soviet Union. Of course, we didn't even talk about that. Communism, capitalism. And the end of the 20th century, most of the Jewish people are in Israel and the United States. And the physical dislocation of communities, the disruption of tradition, of communal traditions. Right? When I grew up in the 50s, it was all very clear. You went to shul, you went to the Beit HaKnesset, and it was all very clear. Everybody was Ashkenazi. There weren't Sephardim in the world. There weren't Hasidim in the world. Everybody was, even though it was the United States, etc., but all the people there came from Hungary or Romania or Germany, more or less, and they all had the same traditions. They all davened in the same, they all had the same nusach. Right? When you said Shulchan Aruch and Shachar in the morning and Shachar, everybody knew how to, what they were supposed to do. But that sort of disappeared, become much more spread up. So we have gone through this kind of a period. It's clear that the period that we're speaking about this week, the return of the Babylonian exiles to Israel, is a similar kind of period. And I would like to talk about the Anshei Knesset HaGdola in that context, in that vein, okay? And try to understand. Did they perceive radical change that the Jewish people were undergoing? Were they able to understand it? What did they create that was a revolution in the concepts, the basic concepts of Judaism? And I would like, perhaps, if we have time, towards the end of our meeting here, the sort of intimate little group here, to ask you. Let's say we're at the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the beginning of the 21st century. Okay, what do we think should be the issues, you know, that the Jewish people need to confront if we speak about spiritual leadership in a new time? Okay, hopefully we'll have time to get to that. And before I actually begin, I would like to connect this a little bit to something we did yesterday. Yesterday in our session on the Beit HaMikdash, we read a section from the prophet Haggai, who was sent by Hashem, what's written in the text, to reawaken the interest in building the Beit HaMikdash. After the Jewish people began building the Beit HaMikdash, they assumed that that's actually what had to be done. Came back to Israel to do that. And then because of the conflict with some of the non-Jewish tribes that lived in the area, they stopped building the temple and they needed to be encouraged to do so again. But what's interesting in Haggai that we didn't have a chance to look at is as follows. When the Jewish people begin to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, okay, they think that what they have to do is build the same thing that was standing in the first Beit HaMikdash. So the first thing that they do is they send emissaries to Lebanon, because you don't build the Beit HaMikdash without bringing cedars from Lebanon. That's what the way Shlomo did it. So we're going to bring cedars from Lebanon to build the second temple. And it doesn't work because political reality is not the same, and there's not a covenant between the house of David and the kings of Lebanon as there were in the time of David and Shlomo. And it doesn't work. And that's one of the reasons that they're not able to build the Beit HaMikdash. And then Haggai at a certain point comes to them and says, wait a minute, you don't understand something. What you have to appreciate is that the times are changing, as you know, the great
Nobel laureate.
Great Nobel laureate said to us.
Nobel laureate, yes.
Also a significant spiritual figure at a certain level. He talked about radical new things that are happening in the community. Anyway, so Haggai says, this is a different time. You've got to learn that even though we're building the Beit HaMikdash, and we all thought that what we were doing when we came back to Israel after 70 years was sort of just trying to create a connection, right? There were these elders who, when they began building the Beit HaMikdash, began crying because they remembered that. So there's a possibility of remembering what it was like. 70 years is not a long time, 70 years. But Haggai says, no. There's something different that's happening now, and you have to be aware of that in order to create Judaism, in order to even worship Hashem. Okay?
Recreate.
Absolutely. Let's take a look at a section from Zechariah, which is number one here. Text number one, something that I think I mentioned yesterday, but it's worthwhile reading it here. A very famous section that's read in the Haftarah for Hanukkah. Zechariah also lived at the same time as Haggai, and he's also encouraging the Jewish people to reawaken their interest in building the temple. But he, as we'll see here, says something very interesting. Anybody would like to read section number one?
And the angel who spoke with me returns, and he awakened me as a man who wakes up from his sleep. And he said to me, "What do you see?" And I said, "I saw, and behold, there was a candelabra."
A menorah.
All of gold, with its oil bowl on top of it, and its seven lamps thereon. Seven tubes each to the lamps that were on top of it.
Okay, let's try to just get a very quick picture. Right, we have a beautiful giant menorah. I'm not a very good painter. Okay, we have there are candles. Okay, and there are tubes, sinarot, that are pouring oil into the menorah. Right, that's what we mean by seven tubes each to the lamps. That is to say, apparently there are seven each. So there are 49 tubes pouring oil into the menorah. Okay? That's what he sees. That's his prophetic vision. I'm sorry, what is your name?
Alvin.
Alvin. Right, I remember. Okay, Alvin. Okay, Pasuk 4.
And there were two olive trees near it. One on the right of the bowl and one on the left.
Olive trees, giant olive trees. Okay.
So I answered and spoke to the angel who talked with me, saying, "What are these, my lord?" And the angel who spoke with me answered, and he said to me, "Do you not know what these are?" I said, "No, my lord." And he answered and spoke to me, saying, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel."
Zerubbabel is the leader of the Jewish people, the political leader of the Jewish people.
"Saying, not by military force and not by physical strength, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts."
Okay, we should say it, read it in the Hebrew. "Ze dvar Adonai Zerubbabel lemo lo b'chayi v'lo b'choach kim b'ruchi amar Adonai Tzvaot." Why is the angel playing this game with Zechariah? What do you see? He says, "I don't know." So suddenly he says, "What do you mean you don't know? You really don't know?" And then Zechariah says, "Yeah, I really mean I don't know." Why is the angel playing this game with this prophet? It's a dialogue between, an emissary from God and a prophet. And it's written here in the text, so there must be some interest, concern that the text has for us. We need to see something. We're supposed to learn something from this. Why is he doing this with me? What's your name?
Brian?
Okay.
It could be, and this is my own interpretation, that you see what's there in front of you. You know it's a menorah. Follow through with what you know that needs to be done. You don't need divine intervention to do what needs to be done.
And so he's saying,
follow what you know needs to be done. You don't need my advice. You don't need the word of Hashem to say that's a menorah. Make one.
Okay. All right. He sees that this is a menorah, okay, but he doesn't know that he's supposed to make it. But I mean, he sees the menorah. That's
yeah.
Okay. Let's go back and try to understand what right. He sees. I saw and behold a menorah of gold. And he saw all of this, two olive trees. And he says, "What are these, my lord?" Okay. All right. Could be that the angel is saying to him, "You understand. You know what you're supposed to do." Okay, what else can we suggest? Sorry, what's your name?
Howard.
Howard, Ken.
Maybe way out. I'm going on a TikTok thing that it says, what are these?
Ken.
Meaning plural.
Okay.
So the these would have to be the olive trees. No, I'm saying the last...
The olive trees themselves.
The olive trees themselves, because that's the last phrase before, what are these?
Okay.
And they're saying, yes, it's true, you have this gold, beautiful menorah, but that's not the essence of it. The trees that surround it, that provide the food for the spirit, for the candelabra,
okay.
These, that's...
So what did Zachariah mean when he said, what are these?
He meant the olive trees.
Right, but what is he asking?
What is the significance of having two olive trees?
I'm having these two olive trees in his vision.
Well, maybe he knew the chumash, I assume he knew the chumash, and he knew about the candelabra.
Okay. He's at... Okay, let me go along with Howard for a minute. He's asking, right? What, I see this vision. I don't understand what it's all about. I don't understand why the olive trees here. I know it. I know there's a menorah. Maybe even I know that we have to make a menorah. I don't understand what this is all about. Why are there two olive trees? Why are there seven tombs for each one of these? You know, so there's these olive trees pouring this. How much oil is being poured into this menorah? Miskin, the small menorah, has got all this oil pouring in from both sides. What are you trying to tell me? I don't understand. And the angel says, I thought you're a prophet. You're supposed to understand. And the Zacharias says, I'm sorry, I don't understand. And then the angel says to him, I'll tell you what this means. And we'll come back to our question in a minute. What he means is that this new temple that we're going to build is different than the first temple. In the first temple there was a menorah. There are a number of menorahs. Shlomo built a few menorahs. But in the Mishkan, there was one menorah. And there was the table with the bread. Okay. In the second temple, the menorah is going to be, wow. It's going to be a giant menorah. You know, when you build it, it's going to look like a regular menorah, but symbolically, it is going to become the most important vessel in the second temple. And it is going to represent, the menorah always represented in the temple, right? There was the, look like another menorah here, but there's like a table with the 12 loaves on it, mm-hmm. right? And they're opposite each other, okay? Symbolically, what does the table represent? What is the table with the bread?
Physical world.
The physical world and your parnosa, your livelihood. 12 tribes. Mm. 12 tribes have 12 portions of Israel that give them life, give them physical life, give them livelihood. That's the Shulchan. The menorah says, The blessing of life comes down into the world, not just in terms of your the bread that you put on the table. It comes down into the world as light, as spirit, as Torah. And there's going to be an imbalance in the second temple. There's going to be an asymmetry in the second temple between the size of the Shulchan. It's going to be this physically, it's going to look like the same. But symbolically, the Shulchan vis-a-vis the menorah, it's going to be totally asymmetrical. There's going to be an imbalance. The menorah is going to be what the Second Temple is really all about. And the Shulchan, that's not going to be so important. And that's what the angel says. The angel says, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by military force, and not by physical strength, not by the physical side of reality. The Jewish people are not going to really have sovereignty. They're not going to have national sovereignty for all of the 480 years, whatever it is, or 510 years that the Second Temple stood. There's not going to be any political sovereignty. You can speak about the Maccabees. Okay? From the year 167 towards 100 years, because then the Romans came in and turned Israel back into a province, a Roman province. So real political autonomy existed in the Second Temple for only approximately 100 years, and some people would even say that the Maccabees, we have some questions about that, but let's... Okay, so about 100 years is political autonomy. So that this side of the world is going to be smaller than it was in the first temple. There was the kings, the army, and the political autonomy of those people for 400 or 500 years had political independence more or less in this country. What the Second Temple is going to be all about is the strengthening and deepening of the power of the menorah. The menorah is not going to be the same menorah, as you said. It's going to be, take a look at the trees. The trees are going to be pouring oil into this menorah, pouring oil into this menorah. And the menorah is going to have, each one is going to have 7 tubes of oil. It's going to be, wow, how much light is there going to be in this?
Almost Orgonus.
Or?
Orgonus. The original.
Maybe. Who knows? There's going to be the tremendous light in the Second Temple. Why didn't Zechariah see that? Why didn't Zechariah understand that? Like you ask.
He's a literalist.
Harry?
Maybe he's just a literalist. Just takes things literally.
Takes things,
because
well,
I never knew he's that. And I've taught this, have taught to Bar Mitzvah students for 30 years.
Right.
And now I understand.
I want to thank you for coming to Pardesville, but he's a prophet. He's supposed to understand. That's what a prophet is. A prophet's supposed to get this vision, and then he's supposed to say, okay, prophet, what does this mean? And he'll tell you what it means. This means this, and this is that, and this is that. What this is pointing to is that this is a period where prophecy is ending. The prophets don't see as much as they used to see. Zechariah is almost the last prophet. Prophecy is ending. Right? Who's going to take the place of the prophet?
The rabbis.
The rabbis. We need to think about that for a minute or two. Can rabbis replace prophets? What do prophets do that rabbis can't do? What do rabbis do that prophets can't do? Prophets, this is the last prophet. One after Zechariah, there's only Malachi, and then it's all over. And they basically leave at the same time. There's a tradition in the Talmud that says that Zechariah and Haggai were in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. They themselves passed, had a personal biographical passage from the prophetic to the rabbinic within their personal life. Okay, I want to ask you a question that we'll talk about. Can you think about people that you know in this generation who maybe came from Europe, came to the United States, or who knows what, were born, lived the life, and they themselves passed, had a passage, a biographical passage between one form of Jewish spiritual leadership to another form of Jewish spiritual leadership within their own lifetime as Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, who were prophets, but also members of the Knesset HaGdolah. And so they were also prophets and also rabbis, and they managed to pass, to have this biographical, it's not an easy thing to do, to change your life, attitude, perception, position in terms of the way you understand, the way that you deal with your relationship to the world, relationship to society, to God, whatever. And you move over to something else. Okay? Think about that for a minute. And we're going to talk about that later. Okay? So this is a radical statement on the part of Zechariah. The first, second temple is not like this. Second period in Jewish history, not like the first period in Jewish history. It's everything. Nothing's going to change. Okay. One more text, and then we're going to go into Chavruta. Text number two. Who would like to read it? Very famous text.
It said, Rabbi Abdimi.
Remind me, what's your name?
Joel.
Joel. Thank you.
Said Rabbi Abdimi of the city Haifa. Since the temple was destroyed, prophecy was taken away from the prophets and was given to the wise. How is this to be understood? Can a wise man not be also a prophet? In other words, were all the prophets fools? He means to say that although it was taken away from the prophets who were not wise, it was not taken away from the wise ones. Said Amamar, and a wise man is better than a prophet, as it is written, obtain a heart endowed with wisdom, and usually who is dependent upon whom? The smaller is dependent upon the greater.
Smaller is dependent upon the greater. There's a play on words in the Hebrew. Obtain, which is in the parentheses, it's Nabi. In the Hebrew, it's like the Navi has a heart endowed with wisdom, and as the Gemara continues to say, the smaller is dependent upon the greater, so that the prophet who is dependent on wisdom means to say that wisdom is a greater quality, attribute, than being a prophet. The play that the Gemara, just to say it in terms of explaining the question here, the Gemara is difficult. The Gemara doesn't want to assume that the prophets were not wise. They don't want to create a complete, negation of these two qualities. It's clear that the prophets were wise, but the time has come for a new dimension of human personality to become the dimension, the prism of the revelation of Torah. Once upon a time, it was prophets. Prophets were also wise. But now, prophecy has ended, and there are wise people, and wise people are greater than prophets. That is what the Talmud has to say. Let's ask this question. This is a very famous text. Many Jewish philosophers have talked about it and tried to understand it. Rav Kook, Rabbi Tzadok, the Rambam. Why is wisdom a greater asset for the revelation of Torah? A greater asset for leadership than prophecy? Not an easy question. Let's sort of go around the room. Ken, what's your name?
Robert. And we got into this in one of the other classes.
Yes.
The point is that a prophet is getting his message directly from God, and gives his prophecy without any editing, whereas once the power, if you will, shifted from the prophets to the rabbis, the rabbis were using their intellect, their learning, their logic to expound the Torah in a way that the prophets didn't.
Why is that important? What does that give them or us?
Well, it means, I guess it underscores the proposition that the Torah is no longer in heaven.
And therefore,
why
is that? Why is that?
It's our responsibility in terms of learning and expounding.
Okay, so it creates more human responsibility, because the prophet would tell us what God thinks, and now we need to use our own capacity to expound, to understand, and so it creates greater human responsibility in receiving of the Torah. Okay, number one. What else can we say?
I think we attended the same class, right?
Okay.
I think the words are quite similar.
Who was the teacher?
It's internal rather than external.
Which means?
That what comes from within. Well, you might describe it the way you just did, that the table versus the trees. You know, it, it, it grows from within and it pours out directly into
the beautiful, beautiful image, okay.
And if it's just from the other, it's like you've gone to the baker, you got a piece of bread, you cut it up and eat it. Nice, you have nothing to do with it.
In the time of the mystery, you couldn't go to the bakery, you had to grow the wheat again. Wasn't so simple, Ken. Why? So what's into, what do you mean by internal and external? Why?
Well,
so if it comes from within, why is that good?
Because you've thought about it.
You've thought about
it's
it.
It's the way you live.
Okay.
And you're part of Earth.
What I hear you saying is internalization.
Yeah.
Besides responsibility, it creates possibility of identification and internalization. It becomes part of me.
Right.
It's not something that somebody tells me about. Right. The prophet comes and says to me, this is what you need to do. This is something that I need to now learn how to identify with and internalize. And it grows, that gives the possibility of growing within me.
Right.
That's number two. Yes. What's your name?
Andrew. I'm grasping here a little bit, but there's something about reason and the function of reason in this to discern what is.
Okay.
And this is related to the what's inside of me. And to the extent that we will have conflict, one of the problems at the time I'm in Maimonides deals with this is what do you deal with false prophets and how do you adjudicate between competing conceptions? And if you have something that's internal and you can not only use reason to discern what is just and what is right with law, but also use reasons to explain why the law ought to be what it is, you're going to be much more, on a stronger base for adjudicating and legislating moving forward than you would reaching from the external.
Okay, Andrew, I got to ask you, what's your profession?
I did do political philosophy for a long time.
Okay.
I'm the head of the Federation in St. Louis. I'm also, we're alum in the same institution. University of Chicago.
UC.
Probably a little bit after me, but we weren't there because we can play basketball with the same people.
Yeah.
I would like to try to expand just a little bit on what Adam said, and then we need to go on. There's also a gift that this process gives to the Torah itself. It's not just human responsibility and internalization, which is very important. That's to do with us. Human beings becoming part of the Torah. The Torah becoming part of our own life. It also is an aid for the explication of the Torah. When you speak about adjudication, clear adjudication, which the prophet did not do, and the rabbis do all the time in the Beit Midrash, they expound, when you expound on the Torah, you make the Torah clearer. You take the Bible, the Tanakh, and you show, you're not supposed to steal. What does that mean? I'm in so many different situations in my life. Somebody's got to explain to me what the boundaries are between stealing and between...
Stealing and borrowing.
Or borrowing, yes. Borrowing somebody else's car. You're allowed to use it. He doesn't know that, you're going to take care of it. And you're going to use it to... You're going to use it in order to make sure that the tires don't get
flat.
Or you're going to use it for your own personal purpose. What's the boundary here between this and that? Right. This is the Gemara. It's not written in the Torah anywhere. So the Torah itself benefits from this transition. Okay.
Sort of evidentiary proof that the original prophets, their prophecies didn't work. There was a tremendous amount of avodah zarah. They had to keep haranguing the people, the prophecy didn't work. But with the rabbis, it always amazed me. At the second temple, no more avodah zarah.
Right.
Wait a minute, I'm not following that. Can you explain that again? We're talking about the rabbis at post second temple.
I'm talking about the rabbis in the Second Temple as well.
Yes.
And the Second Temple was... the rabbis themselves said the Second Temple was describing...
They may not call them rabbis, but the expounders.
I mean, maybe there wasn't a avodah zarah, but there was chaos in the community.
There was interpersonal, Jewish strife, as you said. That's an interesting question. The rabbis were able to...
power.
Howard said the rabbis were able somehow to get rid of Avodah Zarah, the idol worship. Didn't exist in the Second Temple. They were not able to get rid of something that began with the selling of Joseph by his brothers, which is that the Jewish people don't seem to be able to get it together often in terms of interpersonal strife. That the rabbis were not able to do, and apparently up until today, they were still working on it.
The prophets couldn't do it either. They had 10 tribes. No, right.
Okay. Okay, what I'd like to do, I'm sure some of the other sessions you worked on the first mission in the Sefer Avot, Moshe received the Torah from Sinai. And did you work on this in other sessions yet?
None that I worked on.
Okay. So we're going to look, I would like to just say quickly, one of the things that's attributed to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah that we're not going to have time to look at is that they basically created the framework of prayer that we have today. According to these texts, they created the prayer, the Shemona Esrei, the prayer book. The basic framework of the prayer book that we have until today is attributed to this group. And I'd like you to put that in the in your pipe and smoke. And when we talk about it later, take that for granted. We're not going to have time to look at the texts that say that. But remember that as a critical point. I would like you to look at two other texts that describe the revolutionary acts of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. One of them is the first, very, very famous first mission of Avot, which is number 3 in the sources. Okay? And then I'd like you to skip to number 6. Okay, these two sources are, my understanding, they're among the 3 or 4 sources that really give you a picture of what we're looking at, what we're looking for. What was the nature of the spiritual leadership of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah? What was the nature of the revolution that they, when they recreated Judaism for the Second Temple, when they in fact actualized this picture? What does it mean to turn this picture into reality? You need human beings to tell you, well, how do we turn the menorah into the major vessel of the receiving the blessing of God in the Second Temple? What is it in these two sources that helped me understand something about the revolution that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah brought into Judaism? Okay? That's our question for Chevruta. We've got till about 12:30, about 35 minutes. Okay? Is that clear? Anybody have any questions? Ken, what is your name?
Ted. When you're looking at the men of the Great Assembly, are you looking at a group of men who existed at one point in time, or are you looking at people who existed over a century or more, or a little bit of both?
Okay, I skipped all that. In fact, there is a great deal of historical scholarship today. This connected with today, for the last 70 or 80 years, when let's say historical scholarship met study of Talmud, one of the great questions was who were these people really? Exactly the questions that you asked.
Well, what's the answer?
In a minute, I'll tell you what the answer. You know, you have to be a little bit in there. Wait for the answer a little bit. The Talmud talks about 120 people, right? Which is a strange number, because in the Torah it's always 70. Yeah. Right? Moses always got 70 elders.
770.
So where did he get 120 from? But the tradition in the Talmud everywhere is 120. In Ezra and Nehemiah, where you would expect to find, or in Divrei HaYamim, where you would expect to find, well, if there was this group, maybe they should be described here. So there is a description of all kinds of leaders. There are names of leaders that always appear and reappear. But there is never in Ezra and Nehemiah and Divrei HaYamim any reference to a group that could be connected to this group. Even though in the Mishnah, in Avot, we find it in the first Mishnah, and then Shimon HaTzadik is the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. So the answer to your question is what does historical scholarship say? What does historical scholarship usually say? There are many different answers.
There is
a sense that there was a group of leaders of this kind. We do not know a great deal about than historically, except for the few sources that we find here. There's almost nothing in the Tanakh. The assumption is that it is the beginning of the Second Temple period, and they lasted for approximately 100 or 150 years. It's a period in Jewish history that we almost have no, what do you call it, no tehillim, no
record.
No records for.
Documentation.
No documentation. So, because, I mean, the period of the Talmud, the discussion of the Talmud really begins with Hillel and Shammai, which is about 400 years later. Hmm. Or 450 years later. We know a little bit about the Hashmonaim, we know about them, because there's the Maccabees 1 and 2. But before the Maccabees, we don't know a great deal about the Persian period of the Second Temple era, and therefore we don't know a great deal about who they really were, how long did it take. But it seems, it's taken for granted that they lasted for a few generations, and they in fact did create a revolution within Jewish history.
So it's starting about when and finishing about the time of the Greeks.
The time of Ezra Nehemiah, which is about 500 BCE.
Starting with them,
and going for about 150 years.
When the Greeks came over?
A little before the Greeks, during the Persian period. Still before the Greeks come a little bit later.
So some of them were contemporaries, and some of them were one or two generations
right.
after.
The Mishnah says Shimon HaTzadik was the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Okay, there's a Mishnah in Avot. So apparently there is a period in which there some are contemporaries and some are. It's apparently an institution that lasts over a few generations.
Are you including any of the prophets in this group?
I mentioned a few minutes ago the Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, right. According to the Talmud. We're in the first generation of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah.
Not Ezra, not Nehemiah.
Mordechai is put in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Ezra and Nehemiah, as far as I know, are not.
Zechariah?
Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi are assumed to be members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Okay, let's go into
Chagutah. Was it a self-appointed group?
Did you ever see in the Jewish community a self-appointed group that worked? Come on. We don't know. I assume not. If they're not prophets, they're part of the community. Okay, well, I think we don't know a great deal about how it actually worked. Okay?
I'm going to say three and
six.
Three and six, yes. And the question is try to. The text does not tell you Alvin.
Oh, you're Avraham or
what's the revolution
Alvin,
that is being described?
Because we're talking
about the way it's described as a revolution, and we're trying to elicit the what it might have been from what the text says. Okay? You mentioned these qualities that were critical in terms of the revolution of passage from prophecy to wisdom or rabbinic Judaism. Just put them on the board. These things we've already mentioned half an hour ago: internalization, first identification, the Torah, personal responsibility, greater personal responsibility that needs to be taken, greater clarity in terms of the understanding of the Torah, exposition of the Torah, explaining it, developing drashot. Taking sukkim and showing what their meaning is, and an adjudication, which is very important.
But why don't you put reason up there?
That's the I didn't put the title. That's what this is all about. Unless you want to put that as a separate category. I understand this as this is what rationality is all about. Okay, this is what rationality does. That's why rationality, in a sense, replaces a prophecy. Okay, I didn't put that external, this internal. These are basically the notions that we talked about. We didn't speak about these acts that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah promulgated, and the Talmud talks about them. So I put them on the board already to make sure that they're here. Rabbi Soloveitchik says a very interesting thing in the Holy Man of Faith. He says that prayer replaces prophecy also in a sense that the prophet speaks the word of God to human beings, and when that ended, it was necessary to replace that with speech, creative Torah speech, but now it is the responsibility of human beings to create creative Torah speech. And so now, the dynamic was reversed. Instead of God speaking to human beings about God's word, it is human beings who are speaking to God about human beings' word, and that's what prayer is. And that prayer and prophecy are really two negatives of each other. A very interesting idea that preserves the communication, the direct communication. God initiated the direct communication, that's prophecy. When that ended, human beings take over and initiate the communication by praying. Very interesting idea, but again, something that we're not going to spend a great deal of time on. It's something that we need to be aware of in the background. Okay, let's speak first about the first Mishnah in Avot. Let me just sort of illuminate for a minute what we're looking at. The Mishnah, which is a great project that Pardes Seminar, executive seminar, I concentrated on a couple of years ago. The Mishnah is edited by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, 130 years approximately after the destruction of the Second Temple. Right, on a certain timeline, it is somewhat parallel to being 70 or 100 years after the destruction of the First Temple. Of course, there's a difference. 100 years after the destruction of the First Temple, the Jews are coming back to Israel. When Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi edits the Mishnah, he knows that's not going to happen. He knows that there was an attempt 30 years ago at the time of Bar Kokhba, when everybody assumed that the Jews only go into exile for 70 years. You don't go into exile for more than 70 years, right? Between the first and second. Historically, that's what the reality was. So everybody knew that the Bar Kokhba would be victorious and we would all come back and build the temple. When it turned out that he lost, and not only did he lose, but all of the communities in this part of Israel were wiped out, and Judaism also, the center of Judaism became the Galil. Okay, everybody understood that this is going to be much longer than 70 years, and that's when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wrote the Mishnah. But in the Mishnah, he's doing something very similar. He's trying to reconstitute and recreate Judaism. And so he sees the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah as a model. Okay? For him, or for them, for his own group of scholars in the working on the Mishnah, because without the Mishnah we wouldn't be here, pretty much. They took the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah's ideas and strengthened them, sort of rephrased them and reformulated them. But what I want to say is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, when he wrote the Mishnah, he doesn't do. He's not a. Shall I say? He doesn't know how to write decent, a good article. He begins in the first Mishnah, Masechet Brachot. He says, okay, when do you begin saying Kriyat Shema in the evening? Well, wait a minute, what's Kriyat Shema? Who said you're supposed to say it? Where's it written in the Torah? Forget it, you're supposed to know that. When do you begin saying Kriyat Shema in the evening? Okay, but when you get to Masechet Avot, this is the place where he begins to explain to you in his own way something about what the Mishnah really is. And when he does that, he begins with the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. And that's the importance of the first Mishnah of Masechet Avot. Okay? Moshe received the Torah from Sinai. Yes. Why didn't you begin the Mishnah? Why didn't you begin that right at the beginning of the Mishnah? Why didn't you begin everything right there? No, that you're going to begin with Kriyat Shema even. We get someone way back at the end of Nezikin, I'll tell you, Moshe received the Torah at Sinai. He gave it to Joshua. Joshua gave it to the elders. The elders gave it to the prophets. And as we now know, the prophets ended, and that's where the unshakenness of the Lord began. Right? That's where he begins the Masechet Avot. Okay, the rest is up to you. So what did you learn from the Mishnah? What did you see in this Mishnah about the revolution of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah? What can you say, Brian?
This is the method by which the rabbis, both of the Mishnah and in earlier times, established their authority to legislate to Klal Yisrael. Where we went where before it was God to them, they're saying God has imbued in us through this transition the authority to, from now on, establish laws that will be binding.
Where did you see that?
Well, it says when they Basically saying that the starting with initially the men of the God, you know, the method by which they handed it down. This is first to Moshe and then to Joshua, and we're that next stage. And you know, we would not do anything that would you know, there are no more prophets. We're the next, and you notice they don't put a question mark, they just make it sound like it was a fait accompli. This is the way it's always been.
Okay. Let's go on. Ken, anybody else want? What do we hear from this first Mishnah? Ken.
Well, when they talk about what they, the only ones they give content to are the men of the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, and I think we see in there the concern of the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, they're concerned for the future, and they're kind of institutionalizing things.
How are they concerned for the future?
Well, because of the three things that they stated.
Right.
Well, especially develop disciples, it's obvious.
Well, disciples, that's obvious. Why is that obvious?
Nothing's
obvious.
To carry the words of the Torah and that the observance of Torah and everything else, you need other people to pass it on to future generations.
Okay.
To make a fence for Torah also is very, I think, future oriented. They're setting up the institutions of how it's going to be. It's not just going to be personal inspiration and one guy standing up there and telling you what to do. We have to have a structure for people, and they're not even going to be able to always run to the rabbi necessarily. So we're going to set these rules down, and we're going to make fences so that people won't transgress.
Okay.
And then being deliberate in judgment. It's kind of, I think that's less obvious to what I said, but it's also kind of saying this is the process by which you'll judge, and the explanation also shows us if the same questions ruled upon deliberate again that there has to be this continuous process because we're in a new age now.
Continuous process of what?
Of deliberation. You can't just go by your instinct.
Anybody
everything
else
has to be processed. Yeah.
Come back and talk about these things in a minute.
I think they were also, by this chain of transmission, giving themselves legitimacy.
Okay.
They're giving
themselves legitimacy.
Yes.
You mean the rabbi?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's very important. I'll put it out right here. But, like, we are part of the chain of tradition. Even though we're doing who knows what through tradition, right? We're doing something to the prophets, but we are part of the chain of tradition. I mean, the whole chapter here of the book starts at Moshe. Where does it end?
With them.
Who's the last one on the chain in this?
Rabbis.
Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is writing this. He starts with Moshe, goes to the book. We have time to look at the whole first chapter of Bavuk. But the last one on the chain is me. I'm writing the Mishnah. And I want you to know that even though the Mishnah is not written in the Tanakh, right? I'm in the tradition. And I receive the tradition. A direct chain. I can show you a direct chain from Moshe to me. I can show it to you. I can write it on a piece of paper. It's direct from me, from them to me. That's what the Rambam did, the beginning of the Mishnah Torah. In order to write the Mishnah Torah, do a revolutionary thing, because nobody, until the Rambam, wrote a book of halakha the way the Rambam wrote it. The Mishnah's not the same. So the Rambam has to say, also, listen, I can show you that it began at Moshe, and I can show you one after the other that it comes out to me. So in order to give myself legitimacy, I have to show you that I'm part of the tradition. Gershom Scholem used to say, in order for you to be revolutionary within the tradition, the first thing you have to do is show that you're part of the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And not only show that you're part of the tradition, you have to be in the tradition. Because if you're not in the tradition, what you're going to say, even if it's the same, certainly if it's going to be different, they're going to say, well,
outside it.
I don't even want to say what the next sentence is. But if you want to be part of the tradition, do something within. You really have to be, first of all, somebody who receives the tradition, in order to be someone who can say something about it. That's what the first chapter of the Masechet Avot always does. So-and-so received the tradition from so-and-so. And then he said, but wait a minute, if he said it, was it part of the tradition before he said it? Right? When Shimon HaTzadik said, the world stands on three things, and Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chasadim, right? Torah and worship, and okay? You go down the streets in Israel, you can say, okay, where does this sentence come from? Ha'olam omed al shlosha dvarim. It's written in the Tanakh. That's, you know, so basic to Judaism. No, it's not. Shimon HaTzadik said it. Well, before he said it, was it Judaism? Well, yeah, it was, but nobody really had said it yet. Well, Shimon HaTzadik can say it and turn what he said into Torah, because the first thing that he did is that he accepted the tradition. That's some, I would like to say a couple more things about this Mishnah, because we need to go on. So just to expand on some of the things you said, what's amazing in my opinion about this Mishnah is that it sort of says, like Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, gave it to Yeshua, gave it to the elders, they gave it to the prophet, but they didn't say anything. Right? They didn't say anything. Ah, they gave it to Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Ah, they said three things. But wait, what do you mean they said three things? What about, you know, Moshe didn't say anything, prophets didn't say anything. Of course they said. But that's not what interests us right now. The Tanakh is not what we're interested in. Because now, says Rav Yehuda HaNasi, I know that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah created a new way to talk about Torah. They didn't come and say, well, this is just explaining everything you said earlier today. They didn't come and say, Kol Na Hashem, right? So, thus says the Lord of God. They didn't say anything like that. They said, let's try to understand the Torah. And they began speaking human language. And they began adjudicating, deliberating. They began legislating. They began doing all of these things, and they said it in a different language. Until the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, nobody spoke Torah this way. You got to hear it. It's a way of speaking Torah. You look in the Tanakh. Here and there you can see, you know, Aharon says to Moshe when his two children die, and Moshe asks him, well, why didn't you do so-and-so with the sacrifice? So Aharon says, listen, I'm mourning right now, and a mourner can't do so-and-so. Okay, that's the language that we know is the language of halacha. But the prophets never spoke like that. So Rabbi Yehuda wants to tell me, as far as I'm concerned, nobody said anything until Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Of course, and that's the basis of our life. You don't say anything without quoting a pasuk. But nobody spoke like Ha'amidu Talmidim Al Day. You know, Asu Sa'atullah, you don't find that language. So the first people, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah created a different language for speaking Torah. Now, what did they say? They said many things. For instance, you look at Ezra and Nehemiah, they said, don't intermarry, because that's a big problem now. But he didn't say that. Well, they probably said many, many things. He said, no, they said three things. What does he mean when he says they said three things? He means these three things characterize who they are. This is what I want to say. Is the beginning of the new revelation of Torah. When you say the prophets gave it to Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, and there is no prophecy anymore, and it's now wisdom, what do we mean? Well, we mean, I'll give it to you now, in 10 words, almost. I'll give you the whole story in 10 words. Right? How does it begin? Hamidu Tamidim Al Bei, is that the first one?
No.
What's the first one?
Hevru
Mitunim Badim. Deliberate. What is he? Who's he speaking to? When Anshei Knesset HaGdolah said, deliberate. Who are they speaking to?
To their successors, to the Batei Din.
They're speaking to the courts. Right. This is what you said about adjudication. The first thing they said is Judaism depends on Batei Din. Judaism, who replaces the prophets? The rabbis who sit in the courts and adjudicate. And he says to the rabbis who sit in the courts and adjudicate, this is the way you adjudicate. You not only deliberate, you're deliberate about your deliberation. even if you saw this case yesterday, and it looks like the same case, it's not the same case. Every case is different. Every human being is different. Every adjudication is different. That's what the courts need to know. Okay? The second thing they said, Ha'amidu Talmidim Abbe, Carol spoke about it. Who are they speaking to there when they say Ha'amidu Talmidim Abbe? Who are they speaking to?
Rashi
Yeshiva. The heads of the Beit Midrash. They created what we take for granted is the revelation, the path of the revelation of Torah, that there's a Beit Midrash. You find that with Shmuel, you find that he had students. With Eliyahu, you find it a little bit. It's not a major issue in the Tanakh. They said, students, a listener. Why are students so important?
They're part of the transmission?
They're part of the transmission. But later on in the Avot, we will discover Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, okay, what did he do with his students? He said, what is the best way for a human being to live? I want you to go out and come back with an answer. And they go out. And what happens? What happens when they come back?
They get different answers.
They have five different answers. Each one of the students has a different answer. What's the best way for a human being to have a good chaver? Have a good neighbor. Have a good heart. Have good as eyes that only see good things. Wait a minute. So what's the Torah? What's the Torah? You tell me transmission of tradition? What happens when you have many wonderful students who sit at Pardes and you ask them a question and somebody says, somebody says internalism, somebody says identification, somebody says human responsibility, somebody says clarity, somebody says what happens to the Torah when you have students like that? The Torah grows. It's not tradition in the sense that exactly what somebody said is exactly what you'll say exactly what you heard from your teacher. But you will also say, as you understand, that if there are many students in the Beit Midrash, as Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai taught us, the Torah grows. The image, Joel, the image that you used about the tree, and you said that, there was a great, great, great scholar in the Mishnah, one of the great Darshanim named Rav Loza ben Azariah, who said, I want to tell you what the words of the Torah are like. The words of the Torah are like nails that slam into your back here and don't give you any rest, they move you forward. Okay, that's where it begins. But then he says, you take the nails, the same nails, and you plant them in the ground, and they turn into trees. And the words of the Torah, which at the beginning were like nails that sort of said to you, okay, move on and walk down this right path. The same words exactly will turn into trees that grow and grow and grow and grow. Because every word of the Torah grows into many, many, many words. Sometimes I think about it in terms of, if you took the word, right, he's talked about it, Lo Tignov, two words in the Torah. Take a look at how much Torah is in those two words. When you go into the library, okay, the words of Torah grow like trees. Okay, so that's because there are many students. And there are many, you have many students, you have many communities. Each community has a different path. And it enriches the Torah. Who created that? And the last thing they said was associated with the Torah, which says, of course, we legislate. You said that. We legislate. Not God. We legislate. But our first concern, right, that's legislation, that's up to our right. But our first concern when we legislate is to make sure that the Jewish people keep the Torah. That's our first concern. Our first concern is not just creativity. We know that. We'll do that. That's what this is all about. We're the most creative individuals that have passed through the history of the Jewish people. But the first thing that we do is build a fence around the Torah to make sure that that a Jew does not violate the Torah. Later on, the next mission will show you how creative they are when they do that. The first thing that we do when we legislate is that we protect Jews from the Torah. Protect Jews from the Torah, we protect the Torah from the Jews so that they'll keep the Torah. This is a major revolution. This is not what the prophets did. This is Judaism, pretty much as we know it. And this is what they said. They said three things. And these three things, they created the Beit Din, right? They created the Beit Midrash, the courts, the Beit Midrash. And they created the notion of human legislation which will protect the Torah and protect the Jews from the Torah. Okay.
So I want to understand the rationale for the third one, the fence around the Torah and the pits. If you see what's happening here, a shift from prophecy, from a direct conduit from God to the people, if you cared about the protection of the Torah, you would need a fence around the Torah no more or less than now. If your concern is with people keeping the Torah, you need a fence no different than now. So what changes?
What is now? What do you mean by now?
Now with the legislation, with us taking out, what changes is fence around the Torah instead of being our concern that the people keep the Torah, which is no different than the now. Our concern is now that we're more prone to error because we don't have the direct conduit. Okay, so it's more corrective, a buffer to our error, not the concern.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, that's possible. Okay.
I think the idea of create many disciples, I mean, four in the prophetic period. Hashem just chose the disciples as he needed them. You know, there was no need, no prophet said, oh yeah, I need to pick my successor for the future prophecy. Right. That was picked by Hashem. Now you have to create your own successor. So thus, picking many disciples, homegrown's your next level of Anshei Knesset.
Okay, so now
what I was going to say is I think there's another implication. The idea that their so-called legislation, even unto the words that the Chavrusa say, were already known to Moshe at Sinai, that we're not just part of this tradition, it's part of the whole. It's Torah Misinai.
Right, okay.
Then, by going back to the first phrase.
What Howard is saying is that there's a synergism that is created here now that says that we sit here now in the Beit Midrash and we talk to Torah. Okay? On the one hand, by saying, as the Talmud says, that what we introduce was known to Moshe at Sinai, it does two things. It says, number one, that there's nothing new at all. Well, there's a tradition. That says the other as well, and that is what we think as our own creative thought is something that can be divine. The synergism goes in both directions. It allows, and on the one hand, creates a dynamic that says everything is just tradition. The other hand, it allows for creativity within the tradition. It allows every person to say something and have the stamp of approval. Sinai. Okay, I want to go on the second text, which is a little more difficult. Second text was Yeshua ben Levi asks, but why were they called Anshei Knesset HaGdolah? What's so great about them? Why were they given that name? Well, what did they do that gives them that name? Says Yeshua ben Levi, of course, is approximately 700 years after the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. He lives in Israel approximately around the year 250. 280. So we're about 700 years after the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. He knows that there was a group of people with that very, very significant name. And now he's giving his own interpretation as to why he thinks they received that important title. Nobody else in Jewish history has received such a title. Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the great Sinai, the great Knesset. What did they do that was so great? What's his explanation? He doesn't give me the mission. He talks about something and talks together. What is his explanation? What did you say about this? Come on, Howard, when's the movie here? Because somebody else. What?
I think he.
Can't tell, right?
I think he's. It's my. I think he's referencing. It looks.
So what? What's your name?
Yeah. Oh, I'm. It's
Mike. Mike. Yeah, I'm sorry.
He's referencing the beginning of Shmon Esrei. And certain of those adjectives were deleted.
And was this standard? We're talking about prayer, but it's not talking about it as standardized prayer. Right?
Sounds like the Anshei Knesset Hagadolah were able to rationalize restoration of all of the attributes of God and explain them despite the severity of events that changed it.
Right, that's what Reb Shulman later says. What does that mean? What is he saying?
Right, that they had great wisdom and were able to.
Why is that so great?
It's great because it demonstrates that they had the wisdom and the vision to show how the powers of God are not compromised. They're beyond our understanding. Those adjectives are consistent throughout history, regardless of the ups and downs of history.
Okay, yeah, fair. You said it beautifully. Those adjectives that describe the attributes of God are true about God despite the ups and downs of history, the adversities of history. Well, when they did, that's what they did. Okay, what? Why is that, why is that so? That's, how should I say, that's a great act of creativity. It's a great act of theology. Why does that make them the great assembly when they did that? Why does that make them the greatest? That's a significant act. That's a significant philosophical, theological act. Why does that turn them into the great assembly? What's the danger? What can happen after the Shoah? What can happen after the destruction of the Jewish
people? God died for some people.
Sorry?
God died for some people.
Right? The temple. The Jewish people came into Israel. And they were told, this is your land. You build a temple. You live in this land forever. King David and his descendants are going to be kings forever. They keep the Torah. Didn't work. Temple's destroyed. Jewish people went to exile. And when they come back from exile, it doesn't look the same. It doesn't look the same. It's the menorah. There is There is no, you don't have an army. You don't have kings. You don't have political independence. You're all vassals of the Persians. We're all idol worshippers. Right? And they want you to, if it's a benevolent king, he tells you can build a temple, but if it's not such a benevolent king, he throws you into the furnace, and tells you to bow down to his great idol. That depends on who the emperor is going to be. You're at there and his will. Okay, where's God? Where's God in this story? He's gadol gibor. So Moshe said this beautiful thing: God is a gadol gibor. He's great. He's tremendous, very powerful, and he's awesome. Okay, but he isn't. But he isn't. History, as you just said, history, Jewish history has shown us that it doesn't always look like that. And so when, believe it or not, Yirmiyahu prayed to God, we didn't have time to look at his prayer. When he prayed to God, he sort of didn't say everything that Moshe said you should say. He left out, I remember which one he left out there,
Kippur.
And when Daniel, who was in Babylonia, right, under Nebuchadnezzar, who had destroyed the temple, right, saw that the Jewish people were being enslaved in Babylon, right, he couldn't say, wow, he's gadol, he's the greatest God in the world. He doesn't look like the greatest God in the world. That's a very, very, how should I say, that's a crisis of faith. There are a lot of people who went through the Holocaust, a lot of people today didn't go through the Holocaust. Look at what happened to the Jewish people in the middle of the 20th century and say, where was God? The greatness of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, says Reb Shulman, want you to see if you can accept this. I don't know if what does he do? He says, I want to reinterpret what it means that God is great. Well, that's what this is all about. It's all about exposition. It's all about human creativity. It's all about, you know, wisdom. Okay, well, that's what the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah did. That's what we've been talking about all the time. So what did they do? Oh, they said, oh, God is... What does it mean, God is great?
Mighty. Or
God is mighty. God is mighty and powerful. It means that even though we're in exile, and even though we're subjugated and enslaved by these pagans, we survive over history for hundreds of years, unlike every other people. That's a sign that we are a divine people. I don't know if you heard that. I grew up with that. Mm-hmm. I grew up with that. I grew up with that idea. That the greatness of the... My father, the Holy Prophet, if you know who he is, always quoted this Gemara. He always quoted this piece of the Gemara. And he wasn't talking about Daniel. He was talking about himself after the Shoah, after he lost his brother and his father and who knows what, his mother and his sisters. And he said, no, but God is great because no people has survived for 2,000 years in exile, subjugated in all the different lands by different peoples. And that's a sign of God's providence and presence, that we are a divine people, that we survive in that situation all the time, unlike any other people in every other empire. Well, he said, my father, was a rabbi in Berlin in 1938. And he said to his congregants, they didn't tell him this because he had a Hungarian passport. He said to his congregants, they say that, you know, the 2,000 year ones, the 2,000 year Reich. That's what they said. He said, wear your Star of David in great pride, because the only people that survived for thousands of years are us. They're going to be gone before you know it. And he was brought to the Gestapo to explain how he could say something like that. But that's what the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah said. And they said, what's the other thing that they said here? He suppresses his wrath. How do you like this one? He suppresses his wrath about the Babylonians and about the Nazis. He suppresses his wrath. He's a God of attributes of mercy and compassion about all human beings, even about the most wicked and cruel. He allows them to have free will, because that's what his gamble is on human beings. He allows them to have free will. In the end, he will deal with them. But while he's having compassion on them, giving them free will, you know, a whole bunch of people are suffering. But that's his, and what it was, that's his greatness. That's his greatness, that he has compassion. He's not great because he's so powerful and he wipes out all the wicked as soon as they stand up and want to do what they want. He's great because he lets them live. Because he has compassion on life. That's an amazing idea. That's a beautiful idea. Because sometimes it also affects us, even though we're not the wicked, but sometimes we also ask for compassion from God about things that we did. And we expect God to have compassion on us. So if we want it for us, well, what about other people too? And even though we're mostly fairly decent human beings, if every single time, this is what my father wrote, Dad made faith after the Holocaust, if God intervened every time there was a wicked human being or a wicked culture, there would be no such thing as free will. Free will depends on the fact that it's an absolute thing. And there's compassion. In the end, there is justice. It's always in the end. So then, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah said, is that a fudge? Is that fudging? Because we can't really say, and in fact, the prophets didn't say it because, as the Gemara says, they were truthful when they spoke to God. And so they couldn't talk to God about something that they thought was a lie. That's such an amazing thought. When they prayed to God, they couldn't say what was written in the Siddur, what Moshe said, because reality didn't look like that. But they continued praying to God with the other words. That's what they say about the prophets. But then come the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, and they recreate the possibility and they put it in the prayer book. And they say, even if, you know, if you're in a concentration camp and you're praying, you say, Ha'el HaGadol HaGibol V'Anoah. And even if you're anywhere in the Inquisition in Spain, you say, Ha'el HaGadol HaGibol V'Anoah. How? Well, because it's not like you thought it was. It's different. So I ask you, do you think that's a fudge, or do you think that's creative Judaism? That's human Judaism, internalization, you know, all these things that we talked about. Or is that just, you know, what do you think? Okay.
Without that, I have to call it transformation, turning on your head, that phrase, we cease to exist. Because, you know, they'd be studying us in some college campus. Remember those Jews that wiped out 2,000 years ago? Right. We wouldn't be here if they had not managed to change that. Right. And the Mishnah, which is then continuing, which has even more problem because they're continuing Judaism without sacrifice, point to Anshe Knesset as, this is the roots of where I came from. Right. I got this.
Right. Continuation, this is the paradox. The continuity of the Jewish people rests on the possibility of exposition, of drash. But it has to be good drash. It can't be a fudge. It has to be something that takes you into the depths of Jewish consciousness, even though it transforms the meaning of the word into something that the original meaning may not have intended exactly. But the transformation of the word gadol from being, he can wipe out people in Canaan to mean he's compassionate to all the wicked. Okay? That's a transformation, as Brian says, that creates the possibility of the Second Temple, Judaism, when it's we don't have any military, we don't have a king, we don't have political independence, we're servants of the pagans in Persia. What we have is the menorah, and we say, and we really mean it, because it's part of the depths of Judaism, and somebody has succeeded in taking that from somewhere within the depths of Judaism and placing it here in these words so that we can continue to say, we preserve the tradition of saying what Moshe said, right? So we're in the tradition because we say the words that Moshe said, but we're saying it in a different way so that we can continue saying it, and that's what keeps us alive. That's so important. And that's why they're Gdolim, because they created the possibility of talking to God in the Second Temple.
Yeah. Now, there wouldn't be any state of Israel that we have today without Kael and Koach. Do the people who think that the establishment of the state was premature reference that and say, look, you're not supposed to do it this way?
Well, we have 3 more minutes. No, don't say second. That's exactly where I wanted to go. What I thought would be interesting for us to do, which I don't think we'll be able to do, is as I said right at the beginning, let's say we're the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah now. Okay? Let's say we're sitting around a table here. We're self-appointed. We appoint ourselves as we're the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah. Okay, what do we think now? Because there is another period in Jewish history. Something revolutionary has happened within Jewish history. I tried to talk about a little bit right at the beginning. It's not just the creation of the State of Israel. That certainly is one of the major events. There are a number of other very important intellectual, spiritual, cultural, demographic, I tried to sort of mention them right at the beginning, events that have taken place in the Jewish people in the 20th century. We are now at a certain point, at another place of beginning, where we are obligated to be within the tradition. But I mean, just take the example of what you said. If I, you know, if I live in Israel, my children serve in the Israeli army, and I believe that the Israeli army, whatever, that there is a military here. Puts us back somewhere that the Jewish people haven't been, not for 2,000 years, but 2,700 years. And the military in the time of the First Temple was not always the best military, but I would like this military to be a moral, ethical military. And on the other hand, to be a military in the name of the Jewish people, protecting ourselves from the maniacs who live around here, right? Okay, do I say Hayala Gadolik Yipovei Noah differently? Do I pray differently? What do I do that's different? I can't just say things just like I said them in Chicago when I grew up. You know, even though I was sort of a Zionist, but I wasn't, my reality wasn't. But here it's a very, but it's not just Israel. Again, the United States today, there are many, many things, but we don't have time to talk about it. Post-modernity, it's not even modernity anymore. Modernity is a thing of the past to a certain extent, in many ways. There's such a thing as postmodernism. That is, you know, the narrative, everybody has their own narrative. There are no men and women anymore. There are no Jewish people, non-Jewish people anymore. Everybody's the same, right? Okay, because that's all has to do with your own personal narrative. Okay, so why do we, where are we going? Is rabbinic Judaism the way to do it? Is there going to be, the question I've asked myself for 30 years, 40 years since I began to practice and began teaching this, I always ask myself, there was a passage from prophecy to rabbinic Judaism. Are we now in the throes of another passage from rabbinic Judaism to X? Are we ourselves part of that process? Because I'm sure that even in those days, it wasn't just the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the 120 men of the Great Assembly. They formulated, they were clear, they were wise enough to turn it into institutionalizing it and legislating it, but it certainly was something that was happening within the people themselves. They created, and they weren't speaking the original Hebrew from the first temple. They were speaking a different Hebrew that they brought back from Babylon. It was called Assyrian. So we're all involved in this. We're all part of this. Okay? So there are things that are happening everywhere. We didn't have time to get to it. But your question is exactly the right question, in my opinion. So, okay, so now what do we do?
Made the transition, and then we ran out of time.
Don't tell anybody. What we do is we continue learning Torah. We continue turning to Hashem and talking to Hashem about our existence. We continue doing good deeds, as Shimon HaTzadik says, that hasn't changed. We continue doing all that, and we try to talk about what we need to do today.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.